Welcome to Season 4 of The Farcast, bringing you experts and insiders every week to help you navigate the economic and investing landscape. Now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to The Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. Bringing it around the far turn, here they come on December the 17th, 2020. The last month of 2020 is more than half over. It is behind us in the rearview mirror, and I've never felt this way, I don't think, about any other year in my life, 59 of them so far, that I've been so glad to see go. And yet, markets doing very well. Dow futures, S&P, NASDAQ, all up. We're going to talk about that, Washington and the world, with our third segment special guest, Jack Barugian, who has actually for the past few years at year end here for the Farcast been prescient, equally prescient, of course, is our first guest, Jim Labenthal. You all know Jim as a Farcast fan favorite and a wonderful contributor on CNBC and my good buddy. Welcome back, Jim.
Michael, so good to be here with you this morning. Thank you for inviting me.
We're glad to have you, and we're having T-shirts made. Listen to Labenthal. You just need to do this, folks. Jim, we've got markets still moving higher and making all-time highs at the end of the year. What do you make of 2020, and what does this bode for 2021?
I'm going to echo what you said. I normally don't say too much about the passing of one year to the next, but this is certainly one year I'm ready to put in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, exactly. December 31st, January 1st, they're just days, but they seem more momentous this year. And the big reason is because of the vaccines, which are actively being rolled out to hopefully put an end to this COVID-19 pandemic. I think they will. And I think as you look forward, you're supposed to expect a true economic recovery next year. I use that word true, Michael, because there are some among us who think either this will linger, the pandemic K-shaped recovery that we've been in, or that we're just going to go back to the slow growth of the expansion we had prior to this year. But I don't think that's the case. I think you've got so much monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus with more to come, the possibility of infrastructure spending. And as the people who have been most badly affected by this pandemic start to get back on their feet, get jobs, start spending again, I think you're going to see the economy take off in the second half of next year. The stock market is anticipating it. That's why it's up. Last thing I'll say on this is, and I'm sure you feel the same way, Michael, this is heartbreaking for all the people who have lost loved ones or who are out of jobs or their restaurants, their businesses have closed. It's beyond tragic. And I don't want to miss that point. I know you don't want to miss that point.
No.
As we talk about the stock market soaring to new highs. But it is soaring to new highs, and I think we'll be even higher a year from now.
It is the conundrum of the K-shaped recovery. And, you know, in many ways, there have been a couple of conundrums, if that's the right word. You know, the Fed for a number of years has been trying to restart the economy. And frankly, Jim, a year ago, I thought maybe it was working. We had 3.5% employment a year ago. We had wage inflation, wage gains a year ago, demand-driven wage gains. And demand-driven wage gains get more money into more hands across all aspects of the economy, but particularly the lower 30%. And when that demand builds, lifestyles improve, quality of life improves, and all of a sudden the economy begins expanding and even more jobs are created with 3.5% employment. I was encouraged. Now I'm so worried about that particular cohort, that bottom third of the U.S. economy. And I'm hoping that this economic resurgence will lift some of those fortunes. But I think at least a second half story, Jim, at least a second half story as the economy tries to restart, right? But what do you make of the Fed's efforts to try to get the economy started? What did you make of Powell's speech this week and their target of 4.2% GDP growth in 2021?
I think Chairman Powell and the Fed get an A+ for their actions during this pandemic.
I agree.
And I think way too much has been put on their shoulders to lift. What I'm speaking about is what Chairman Powell has been speaking about, that he can only lend, he can't spend. What you just said about the bottom 30%, what we've both agreed to about the pain that they're feeling through, speaks to the strong need for fiscal stimulus right now. You and I agree, second half of this year, the economy should be doing very well on its own two feet. But we've got to bridge the gap from here to there. People are really, really hurting. This is what government is formed for. You know, Michael, I'm not sure if you were on the show with me. You might have been. I said the other day that, you know, fiscal stimulus, this is what governments are for. This is the Hobbesian jungle that we're trying to avoid from a philosophical point of view. This is the social contract. We pay our taxes so that in times of trouble, those who are needy will get what they need from the government. This is that time. I'm frankly disgusted at how long it's taking. And I know I'm not alone in sharing that, and I'm sure you're going to echo those comments, too, because you're a decent man of integrity. We need fiscal stimulus just to get us through this portion right now. I don't need it. You don't need it. But that bottom 30% needs it. Will the stock market respond to it? Maybe. Who knows? But that's not the reason to give fiscal stimulus. It's for the decency of the people.
Well, I actually was on that show with you, and I tag teamed on following up. Wapner came to me right after that, and I agreed with that, of course, what you said. But I also, you know, suggest that the economy itself is fragile, and for me, Jim, it's a mistake to separate the economy, I don't hear you saying this, but I do hear some people saying the economy be damned, let's take care of these people. I appreciate the sentiment. I want to take care of the people, but you can't say the economy be damned. We have to take care of the economy. The economy will take care of those people. And the Fed's done everything it can. Congress has to do something. Congress has to keep this economy moving. It's fragile. We are at risk of a double dip here. No matter how good this vaccine news is, the numbers don't support it economically. We have to have that stimulus. You get a better economy, it will lift the fortunes of all involved, including that lower third. So it's desperately important that these people quit dithering, quit being political, and get it done. Anyway. Jim, let's talk stocks for a couple of minutes here this morning. We have some pretty high valuations across the board with stocks trading at all-time highs, and we're looking at 22 times earnings right now. We're projected to get, a lot of people are expecting 15 to 20% earnings growth for, as Larry Kudlow said, the mother's milk of stocks for 2021 and 2022. This was the pre-political Kudlow who used to say that. I haven't heard Larry talk about stocks since. But, so will that drive things higher, or will it simply lift the fundamentals such that they support these lofty prices? So, I mean, what I'm saying is, if we got 20% in earnings gains, can we put 20% of that in the PE bank to sort of say, well, that'll lower PEs by a point or two, and then maybe drive them a point or two, you know, the stock's 10% higher or something. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. I think what you're saying is, do stocks grow into the multiple over the next year or two?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is yes, but I'd like to make a distinction here. The market multiple overall is high. It's inflated by a few names, and it's going to get inflated more when Tesla is added to the S&P 500 in the next few days. It's going to get inflated by a few turns here. Now, I'd say this is a little bit stylistic, but I think you've got to divide the market of stocks into three groups. First is value and cyclicals, which if you look at industrials, financials, materials, energy, I think they're still under their fair value. I think there's room for the multiples to expand there because the earnings are going to grow in a true economic recovery. Then you've got growth at a reasonable price, and in that I am including the top five: Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google. Those stocks trade, take Amazon out for a second, but those trade mainly around 29, 30 times forward earnings. For a 1% 10-year yield environment and with the earnings growth that they're showing, That is absolutely acceptable. The third area is the one that I'm worried about. The good news is it's not that big a part of the market. These are the nosebleed stocks. Let's call these growth at a ridiculous price. I am talking about the software stocks. I'm talking about the stay-at-home stocks like Zoom and Peloton. I am talking about Tesla, talking about Okta, Datadog, Mongo, these stocks that I think probably the majority of people who own them don't know what they actually do. But the point being is if you're buying stocks now that have PEs of hundreds of times, not of next year's earnings, but 2023's earnings, you are fooling yourself. I've heard some on air say, well, people are buying them because they don't know how to value them, but they know they've got to own them. That is a paradigm that ends in tears. So the good news here, that growth at a ridiculous price cadre, that's a relatively small part of the market. I don't think it brings the market down if they have trouble in 2021. The rest of the market, the regular growth stocks and the regular value stocks, they can expand their share prices into their multiples because of the earnings growth that's coming.
If I go back to those value stocks, I hear the same sentiment you just mentioned, Jim, of the industrials, financial, energy, that cohort where people say, I don't want to own them. I guess I should because I just should. But are there stocks or sectors ever that really should be left for dead because they are indeed dead, Jim?
Well, I think you're hinting at, and this is why I love talking to you, Michael. You do such good segues. You really do. I think you're hinting at energy. And let's face it, energy does have secular challenges.
I just always expect Weiss is going to call in just if he thinks we're talking about energy stocks.
I love Stevie. Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder.
At any rate, I think energy does have a secular decline in front of it, both because of demand shifting to renewable energy sources and because of the ever-growing wave of ESG, socially and environmentally friendly investing. But even with – so energy, which is 2% of the overall market, isn't a place that you need to be overweighted to begin with, and there's a handful of very large stocks that you can be in, collect the dividends, get a little price appreciation again as the economy recovers. I'm talking about Chevron. I'm talking about Marathon Petroleum. I'm talking about Kinder Morgan. But I think diving down into these smaller exploration and production companies, these mid-cap, what we used to call them wildcatters, they're going to be wild, all right. I think you want to keep these outside of your house.
Anytime I hear that Exxon has to borrow money to pay its dividend, I'm thinking that's not going to end well. I mean, you talk about the stocks of the 100 times earnings that aren't going to end well. I can't imagine how Exxon's going to. I mean, that's got to be a long slog.
I'm sorry I'm interrupting you. I just want to say something about Exxon. I've hated it for a long time because I've been expecting them to take a write-down of their acquisition of XTO Energy about 10 years ago. Well, they took that write-down 2 weeks ago, $20 billion, $20 billion. Interesting. The stock responded positively. I'm not going to own Exxon. I'm a long-term investor, and I think most of our listeners are too. But for a trade, when a stock responds positively to that bad of a news, that sometimes means it's a short-term trade. Not my cup of tea, but I still find it interesting. As a market participant, I look at those things.
It has been a great year for stocks in 2020. It has been a hard year for Americans, and we have endured, we have persevered, and we are coming out the other side. A lot of that here on the Farcast for our listeners is because of the great efforts and wonderful advice and actually upbeat fellowship and kindness that always comes through the remarks of our great friend Jim Labenthal. Jim, thanks so much for being with us this year. We're going to see you next year, and we hope that 2021 is happy and healthy and safe and prosperous for you and your family.
Michael, I have to say I'm grateful for many things in my life, and I've learned with every passing day that gratitude is the best attitude to have. And with
Amen.
That, I want to say I'm grateful to you for being my friend. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, a contributor on CNBC, a contributor on the Farcast, and my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be right back with Dan Mahaffey. We're going to talk Washington, new cabinet appointments, and President Trump's latest when we come back on the Farcast. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us on this week's Farcast. We'd like to invite you to follow Michael on Twitter and LinkedIn. On his social media feed, you'll find links to all of Michael's media appearances, articles he's been quoted in such newspapers as The Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, and, of course, The Farcast. Additionally, Michael shares some of the articles we are reading at Farmiller in Washington every morning that we feel have bearing on the investing landscape. That's Michael_K_Farr on Twitter and Michael Farr on LinkedIn. And now, back to Michael and the Farcast. Welcome back to the Farcast. And now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Thanks for being with us again this week. Dan Mahaffey runs policy at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress and is the longest serving, most fabulous senior political analyst on the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be back. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're glad you're here. You know, Dan, my friend Greg Valliere starts his morning note out today saying there's a reason why Congress has a 19% approval rating. I love that. Right. And boy, it seems true this morning. Do you know that I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, the Tampa newspaper actually did a poll and a colonoscopy actually had a higher popularity vote than members of Congress. Having a colonoscopy was more popular than members of Congress. So as they continue to narrow in on what may or may not be a stimulus deal, people are getting sick of this, I know, but it is so vitally important. Jim Labenthal and I were just talking about the cohort of our population that are suffering, and certainly the economies still in danger of a double dip. So, Dan, are we going to get it? And he's saying, again, $900 billion. I was hearing closer to $730 billion. Where are the numbers and what's happening?
Well, I think, look, Congress always finds a way to procrastinate and push this to the last minute. And look, even Steny Hoyer, who's one of the greats in this town, was lamenting it, that they always push it to the last minute. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, gosh darn it, you're in leadership. I wonder if there's something you could do about that.
Right.
But, you know, that's how Congress works. And look, they're realizing there's the national outrage, which you get is correct. Guy Fieri has done more for restaurants and small business in this country right now than Congress has. And they're moving on this. They've got that. We talked about it. It's $900 billion. They've moved away from the state and local support as well as the liability protection.
Why?
For business.
What's the problem with the state and local support? I mean, the states have got issues.
Yeah, states have issues, but Republicans hate it because they think it's a bailout for Illinois, California, et cetera. On the other hand, the Democrats were highly opposed to any of the liability protections, trying to stop class action lawsuits related to COVID, things like that. So they've put both those things that everyone hates to the side. And then went in, they're going to do the $300 a week on unemployment. They're going to do another tranche of PPP. And it looks like we're going to get those direct payments of probably $600 per person, $300 per child. And there's going to be some kind of income or means test on that. We just don't know yet.
What did you say? We're going to get $600. Is that unemployment or $600 per person?
$600 per person. Unemployment would be $300 a week in federal benefits. That looks like the look, Michael,
is $600 a person going to happen? Am I getting $600? I'm going to get $600.
I think that's going to be tested, though, on income, like the last go around, where perhaps anyone, you know, over $100,000 a year in income doesn't get that. But that looks like it was very important for Hawley and Sanders. Look, Sanders says this doesn't go far enough, but this is what's kind of threading that needle in the Senate and kicking all the difficult stuff to next year, which is, I think, is an interesting way of looking at how Mitch McConnell is setting up things, too, when you look at what he's doing now and trying to put off till next year.
We're wondering if there's going to be some sort of sell the news reaction by markets where they just say, well, now we've got it and there's no news to trade up on. Frankly, Dan, I think that would be a big mistake. Ladies and gentlemen, that strikes me as a big mistake. We are so used to and accustomed to hearing about these enormous numbers in stimulus packages and taxes and deficits and debt that we really become a bit numb and callous to them. Let me tell you something. $900 billion is whole ton of money that will be shoved into this economy. It's basically 5% of GDP, and you shove an additional 5% of GDP in, that's going to make a difference. I used to say that, you know, if I can take $1 billion and shove it into a dead horse, I can get him to take a lap around the track. I mean, that's essentially just physics, right? I mean, there's physics here. So, Dan, as we go through that process, you think it's going to happen when?
I think we're going to get sort of the final text over Friday. Look, there's some deadlines tomorrow. They'll find a way to push them. We'll get the sense of this by the weekend of what the exact details look like. I think a lot's going to unfold today. But that's the goal lines I just sketched out. That gives us a sense of what they're moving towards. And I think it'll be interesting to see how Mitch McConnell sees this as the way some of these moderates in the Senate have pushed the agenda forward. And I think it's a win for him because – now, if government stays open until later in the year and they get some sort of stimulus measure now, he has plenty of reasons when Biden takes office to say, well, we've got everything done. There's no hard bill that you see coming up early in the Biden administration that's a forcing function for any further stimulus or other measures. So by doing this, they've cleared the docket in a way on some of these relief measures, as well as keeping government open.
Pete Buttigieg is going to be Secretary of Transportation. What does it mean that President-elect Biden has nominated him? I mean, it certainly strikes me that it's a fairly strong endorsement of this young man that moves him into that national platform and gives him a platform within the party for the future. But now that's an amateur's view. Tell me what else.
Well, I read a lot of these as Biden announcing he's going to be a one-term president. And you see Buttigieg, you see, obviously, there's no real rival to Kamala Harris, but you see Javier Becerra, Cedric Richmond, Buttigieg, as we mentioned. A lot of rising stars in the Democratic Party are being given prominent positions that they wouldn't get otherwise if they tried to move through the party ranks normally right now. So that's interesting to see. He's approaching it, too, and I think this is going to be interesting when we get to Congress. He's approaching his cabinet a lot more like a team of leaders, or even how, like, the British set up a cabinet with leading political figures and then assume the civil service does the work. So there's going to be questions about Buttigieg's expertise, and he's a charming young man, but that you propose to your husband in O'Hare is not exactly a testament of transportation expertise. So look, it's putting someone forward prominently and building them for the future, which I think is good party building, but it will raise some questions about how he's making these choices.
Now, wait a minute. Sarah Palin's, international foreign relations, foreign policy chops came from her view of the Soviet Union or Russia from her back door.
Look, there's going to be hypocrisy. I'm going to have to call this. I'll call this both sides. The hypocrisy of this is going to be fascinating, though, as Republicans now are talking about all the mean tweets and things that Biden staffers or nominees have said when they've spent the past 4 years saying they don't read the tweets. So, there's going to be hypocrisy on this, but let's call it fairly.
Talk to us about now that you've seen so many of these nominations and we're listening to the president-elect, what sort of Washington will we be living in and listening to over the next couple of years here? How are things going to change in the messaging, in the tone, in policy, and everything else? What's this Washington going to feel like with these people in charge?
Washington is going to feel like a Washington torn asunder. There's a generational
divide. Oh, really?
Correct.
Torn asunder. I was expecting you to say something nicer, like things are going to feel warmer and comfier
and nicer. They're going to try to. I think you're going to see a lot of the older guard, the establishment in parties in the Senate, try to get back to deal making, try to get back to normalcy. They'll try and be a little back to the future, but the forces outside, the media, social media, voters' attitudes, and frankly, this miasma about the result of the election that the soon-to-be former occupant of the White House continues to produce, they're going to try and create a Washington that is in the past, but I don't get how you move beyond the pressures of the future and younger voices in both sides of each party getting more partisan and more demanding, more progressive, more conservative. That's where the grassroots are. So Washington's going to be kind of trying to fight this rear guard action, these old figures, I think, fighting a rear guard action against some of the forces that have been unleashed over the past 4 years.
When I speak around the country, Dan, folks are always saying, Michael, what's happened to the middle? I hate the right extreme. I hate the left extreme. Why can't we have a centrist candidate? Why can't we have people in Washington who represent me? I'm a middle-of-the-road person. And it strikes me, Dan, as the majority feel like they're that middle-of-the-road person. And now we're sort of seeing under a President Biden, we may have that more middle-of-the-road government. I would think America would embrace it. You're telling me it's not going to survive?
Well, the challenge for the middle-of-the-road voter out there is we now live in an America where the politicians choose their voters rather than the voters choosing their politicians. So Mr. and Mrs. Centrist you speak to live in a district that's been drawn heavily R or D by the parties in most states, such that their centrism doesn't matter because it's all about getting 5,000 crazies out on either side to win a primary. That's how Joe Crowley lost to AOC in New York. That you see these in the primaries around the country. So until Joe and Jane centrists say, I'm not giving a cent to a Republican or Democrat until they fix gerrymandering, fix campaign finance, some of these other things, then no one's going to care about you in your centrist position.
Do we see a renaissance of the progressives and of the Tea Party, or are they going to get quieter for a little while?
I think so much of that depends on how we get through this economic headwind over the next few months.
Okay.
Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, that was all because the 2009 to 2010 recovery, you know, moved slowly. That was all a response to that. So how we get through this, and I think that's why, again, I look at the Fed chairman so focused on the Fed's response because he knows the Fed can't survive another cycle where the politics are that the Fed's on the side of the wealthy.
Right. 4.2% GDP growth was the Fed's projection as of yesterday. Mm-hmm. Doesn't sound bad to far, I'll tell you right now. And I am concerned about where we are on market levels and indexes. But in general, we're together. Labenthal is very constructive. We're going to see what Berugian says. He's been somewhat prescient. Dan, any final words? Well, we're going to have one more forecast, I think, coming up. But any final words, just in case we don't, coming into year end here?
Yeah. Keep an eye on this massive hack of the U.S. government by, we think it's Russia, from the statements. We're now looking, I think, at one of the biggest intelligence and cybersecurity failures in this nation's history unfolding. It's been quiet thus far.
How have they kept it quiet? I mean, they hacked the Treasury Department. I've been amazed we haven't gotten more news out of that.
Because we are pantsed right now, and we're trying to figure out whether they're out of the network. So are the Russians still holding our pants down, or have they run away, is what we're trying to figure out. And that's why you're not – that's why you're gradually getting, each new entity that's coming out, as well as the pernicious of this, they chose a software, SolarWinds Orion, to get wonky about it, that is basically in almost everyone's network. They found the most ubiquitous software to hijack, and the impact of this is unfolding and going to be amazing to see. I imagine this should have something down the road like a 9/11 commission to investigate the scope of this.
Why wouldn't an attack like this be seen as an act of war?
Right now, we get the sense that the Russians have purely used this for espionage. This is data exfiltration and analysis. Thus far, none of the conversations I've seen, and that's a caveat, none of the conversations I've seen have indicated that this particular hack was interested in critical infrastructure or critical systems. That said, there's plenty of other characters looking around those systems, too.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Mahaffey directs policy at the Center for the Study of the Presidency, is the senior political analyst on the Farcast, and our good friend. Dan, if we don't talk to you, have a wonderful end of the year and holiday and Merry Christmas, and we will look forward to being together in a better and brighter 2021.
Looking forward to it, and a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays to you and everyone. Happy New Year as well.
We're going to be back with Jack Barugian. He has been prescient in his year-end predictions, and I can't wait to hear what he says when we come back on the Farcast.
The Farcast is sponsored in part by Positano Restaurante in Bethesda, Maryland, 4940 Fairmont Avenue. Positano Restaurant, great Italian food. And now, back to the show, and your host, Michael Farr. Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Jack Barugian is chief economist, co-founder and director of Universal Compute Exchange, the India Compute Exchange. He was CEO of Index Futures Group. You see him on the CME. He's a great media contributor and one of the wisest voices and basically nicest guys you're ever going to talk to in our business and in Wall Street. And, you know, Wall Street is the business. Jack's in Chicago, and we're so glad that he's with us on the Farcast. He has been prescient these past few years on the Farcast in his prediction for the markets for the upcoming year. Can't wait to hear what he says at the end of 2020. Joining me now is my great friend, Jack Barugian. And welcome back, Jack.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's praise indeed, by the way. I appreciate the kind words.
All of it earned, Jack. All of it earned. You know, I get very mean, you know, if you screw this stuff up, and you just don't. So it's wonderful.
I like that.
So, Jack, here at the end of 2020, we have markets, at least stock indices, making new highs. We have government dithering. We have a new president coming in. Tell us how you what you make of all of this.
Well, there were a couple of things, if you remember the last time I was on the show, that I said. One was, if there was ever a time I don't mind losing money on a hedge, this would be it.
Yes.
And that's exactly what I did. You know, you don't touch that portfolio because you know it's running wild, like a wild horse. So you don't want to upset it. You want to make sure it just keeps running. But if you are wrong and there was a hiccup during the election or whatever the case might be, I wanted to be prepared. And it was a hedge worth putting on. Having said that to you, once the market moves 10% and gives a confirmation to the upside, which is exactly what it did, you know, yes. You've got to start to rethink the strategy a little bit. What's happened, and Michael, what I worry about is that we have pulled a lot of the earnings and a lot of expectations way ahead of itself. And now we've priced in perfection. It's gotten to the point where if 21 is not exactly the way we want it to be, we could be in trouble. And now that's really what I worry about.
Okay, so let's just go back for a second to that point of the hedge, because I want our listeners to understand this. I think it's a hugely important point as an investor. There are times when an investor like Jack, like Farr, and you know I'm not a trader, but when you look at that risk reward on the table and say, I'm going to hedge it, I'm going to do something that if everything goes to hell, it's going to protect me. And if everything goes through the roof, it's going to hold me back. And I will be, I have to tell myself in that moment, I'm going to be just fine earning a little less on the upside, knowing that I covered my ass on the downside. Very easy to do in a tumultuous moment. The problem is living with it after the thing goes through the roof and you go, oh, crap, I was wrong. Why did I do that? You weren't wrong. You made the right decision at that moment to hedge your bets. I don't know. Sometimes it's hard for me to make sure that I feel at least as wise after you kind of feel like you missed out. How do you feel? How do you deal with that, Jack?
Michael, I think of it as insurance. You know, quite frankly, you know, when I'm doing a deal, say, for example, I'm doing a deal in oil, I need to make sure that I have got no exposure over the course of, say, 3 months for that oil price, because it's my profit in the deal. So I've got to figure out either a hedge to make sure I lock that in or whatever the case might be. So what I've always thought about it as insurance. So when I put something on, I don't worry about it. Do I worry about, you know, sending in a car premium? No. Or a house premium? No. Not at all. You know, just having the peace of mind of knowing that I can go to sleep because I've, you know, knowing that it's there. There are times in the market where you feel you need some insurance. Now, you and I know selling pieces of your portfolio is not the answer. You know, whenever you do that, it upsets the balance because you've spent a lot of time and effort, or you've worked with a fiduciary that's done that for you. So to sell out is not the answer. That's where a hedge really comes in handy, because it allows you to be able to say, aha, okay, now I can protect myself in the event that the market does go to hell. But on the other hand, you know what? If it doesn't, well, I'm still in, you know, and this market is just going to keep running with me.
Okay, so tell one of my favorite investors, Fred and Ethel, are always trying to figure out what should be happening and what they should be thinking about their portfolios in 2021. We've got indices trading at all-time highs. The Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ have all made new highs in the past month. We're coming into 2021. The Fed's expecting 4.2% GDP growth. Folks are expecting 15 to 20% increasing earnings in the S&P 500. You've set its price for perfection. What do you expect the market's going to show to us in 2021?
Well, I got to tell you, Michael, I'm going to let the bond market and the velocity of either inflation or disinflation, and I'll explain that in a second, make my decision for me. Here is what's happening. Right now, we are looking at a central bank and a global, I guess, you know, cartel of central banks that are debasing fiat currency. And it's across the board. We are seeing it with negative rates globally. We are seeing it with what's out there. There is no alternative but to be in equities right now. Now, having said that to you, you know, that's how capital gets trapped historically. Yes. And I'm not talking about a bubble. I'm talking about a real trap. And the only analogy, I guess, that I'll use is there are so many people right now that are expecting inflation. We're looking at what these banks are doing. We're looking at what's happening, and everyone's convinced there's going to be inflation. Back in 2010, I remember doing an interview with the late, great Mark Haynes, and yes. I remember him saying to me, Jack, I got the 10-year at 1.5. Is it the short of the decade?
Yes. Right?
Can you see it at 6 or 7% by 2020? And I said, because everybody does. And I said, you know, Mark, when everybody expects something, it usually doesn't happen. Right. Which is exactly what happened. And I guess what I'm really getting at is everybody is expecting inflation. Well, I was an officer at a Japanese bank during a period where they fought a disinflationary spiral with negative rates, and they flooded the system, and it didn't work. And I guess that is my concern. That's what I'd be looking for, Michael. I'm going to let that, then that's where the bond market comes in handy. If yields spike, all right, then we're seeing the inflation taken off, and the Fed's work is working for them. If they come off and we start to see, you know, a 10-year down at a half basis point again or lower, and they can't control that, that's telling us something right there.
Those are kind of chilling words, but I think all are wise to heed those words from our friend Jack Barugian with that contrarian opinion. You know, Jack, one of the things that I've been saying this year, and I don't think I've shared it with you, though I almost lost a Fed president when I said this. He almost fell out of his chair. I think Milton Friedman was wrong, who said that, that's when I almost lost the Fed president, by the way, when he said that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. We've had 10 years of monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus. We've had trillions of dollars of liquidity. We've watched the velocity of money, how frequently, folks, money moves in the market, all the dollars that are out there moves, go straight through the floor. Money is not moving. There's no business investment. So what we have found is that all of this stimulus in and of itself does not create inflation because it does not generate demand. Unless the monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus can generate demand, you don't get inflation. And so far, we don't have any increased demand, organic demand. I think we were getting it about a year ago when unemployment was 3.5%. We were seeing some wage inflation. But I think I think you could be right again, Jack. That's something that I've gotten to say so many times over the years. Right again, Jack.
Michael, really what it comes down to is a simple question. What if it doesn't work?
If it doesn't work?
Nobody asks that question. And I guess, you know, in an insane world, sometimes it takes a sane man to look insane. And I guess I look crazy asking that question. You know, but we have watched this. We're watching technology actually be that deflationary pressure that's on the economy. Everything that we're talking about, all the disintermediation that we have been witnessing over the course of the last 8 months is so deflationary in the long run, and people don't understand it.
Yes.
A lot of these jobs that have been lost forever, and you and I know there's going to be pressure on wages to the downside because you've got lasting unemployment. All of this concerns me. These are the things that might manifest themselves regardless of how much money is being printed up and dropped from helicopters by Jay Powell that could really stifle the market over the course of the next year.
I'm going to just jump quickly, Jack, because I know we're running out of time. You were telling us before that you had some investments in gold, even in Bitcoin. They've worked out gold probably fairly static. Bitcoin's worked out very well. I am also confused, Jack, as I look at oil at almost $48 a barrel. I don't get what oil is doing. I rarely do, by the way. But can you give us some thoughts on other investments and areas? Are you still a fan of Bitcoin? Are you still thinking about gold? I don't remember if you did silver. I know Urio did silver. And what about oil at close to 48?
Oil is a different story. Oil is the electronic vehicle story. In fact, if you want to look at oil, look at oil, and then if you want to maybe have a spread on, you buy copper and you sell crude. Why? Because copper is used in the creation of electric vehicles. You have literally 10 times the amount of copper that's used in the electric vehicle than used in the conventional vehicle. Now, having said that to you, if indeed the world is going in that direction, look for copper and the demand for that metal to be just astronomical. All right? Crude oil, on the other hand, has now become a very, very easy commodity. You can find crude oil. I get calls every day asking me if I could buy crude on the market. There's a difference in there. There's a real dichotomy being developed there. Now, having said that, remember, the dollar is also playing havoc with these markets. But that is the market I'd be looking at is copper. I am still long Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin can go to $50,000. There are only 21 million Bitcoins ever been put in circulation. And now people are using a mainstream. Tudor Jones is talking about it. Others are talking about putting it into your portfolio. And you can literally go in and put on a synthetic position and not worry about custody issues or regulatory issues or tax issues because it's a futures contract. And that's really the way to play it for me. I love doing that because it makes life a lot easier. But if they can continue to debase the currency, Michael, all right, people have to have some money in these alternatives because they will lose purchasing power parity over the course of the next few years. The dollar will continue to go down against all global currencies, against metals, against commodities. That's inflation. And that's that other scenario that we talked about.
Yeah. Would you be more concerned that Fred and Ethel today went out and bought Bitcoin or that Fred and Ethel didn't go out and buy Bitcoin?
I'd be concerned they didn't. I think that everybody should have a little bit of it in their portfolios, just like I think they should have a little bit of gold. All right. I don't care. I'm not telling people to be a gold bug. I'm not by any means a gold bug. I've got friends that are what I would consider to be real gold bugs. But everybody should have these assets in their portfolio. That's how you really diversify your portfolio wisely. Now, you can find somebody to do it for you with listed securities, too. There are things out there, and you and I have probably put people into those things. But, you know, the reality is that there has to be room for alternatives that do not correlate with the rest of your portfolio at any given time.
Finally, Jack, okay, we're out of time, of course. It's always such a treat to talk to you. I want to characterize you here at the end of the year as cautiously optimistic or just cautious? Where are we going to leave 2020 and move into 2021 with Barugian?
Cautiously optimistic. If we see the election in Georgia go to the Democrats, then I'm very cautious.
Very cautious.
That'll change the entire dynamic of next year.
If and when that happens, and no matter what, we're going to come back and talk with our friend Jack Barugian in 2021. Jack Barugian is chief economist, co-founder, director of Universal Compute Exchange. He's on the CME. He has been our great friend for years. Jack, we wish you and your family and all of your friends great health and happiness and prosperity in 2021, and we hope you'll come back with us.
Absolutely, Michael, and you and everybody the same to you and your crew, please.
Thank you very, very much. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast. We will be back shortly with a new one for you. We thank you for being with us. Please share us on social media. In Naples, Florida, for the Farcast today, I'm Michael Farr. We'll talk to you next week.